Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. This is our second last weekly show for the year, and this one, 2019, it just flew by. In just a moment, we'll be chatting with Adam Boileau about all the week's security news, and after that, we'll be joined by Brian Robison of BlackBerry Silence, who's popping along to talk about some interesting research they've done on mobile malware. APT crews that have traditionally been focused on desktop malware are really starting to embrace mobile malware, and Brian's got the scoop on that. That is this week's sponsor interview, courtesy of this week's sponsor, BlackBerry Silence. That is, of course, coming up after this week's news segment, which starts now. And Adam, we begin this week's news segment with a story that I love this story. This is hilarious. This guy, Virgil Griffith, who is a member of the Ethereum project, is facing up to 20 years prison because, he allegedly flew off to North Korea to teach them all about blockchain, which is something that the United States government doesn't necessarily think is a good thing.
not so much. No, there's this funny thing called sanctions, whereby perhaps you're not supposed to go and provide material assistance to a country that is your enemy, such as in this case North Korea. Apparently, he was talking at the conference about, amongst other things, using the blockchain and Ethereum and cryptocurrencies in general to avoid sanctions. So, I'm kind of struggling to be sympathetic about this. Like, this seems like a pretty dumb idea.
Yeah, I noticed like 2600 Magazine too on Twitter sort of saying, oh, you know, Virgil's a true hacker and we got to support him and get behind him. And all of the replies were just like, really? It's North Korea, man. They got gulags. You don't help those guys.
No sympathy at all. And yeah, I think the response to 2600 on Twitter was pretty funny. They got smacked down pretty seriously. And it's like the argument that, oh, well, all the information that he would be talking about blockchains or whatever is already on the internet. Like, that doesn't really, that's kind of not the point, right? I mean, going there and talking about it, it kind of involves you personally. Like, the fact that it's on the internet and they can go and research, well, they can go research about lots of things on the internet, right? It's still kind of like there is a material difference there. And, you know, just, I mean, come on, dude, really? What did you expect?
Yeah, apparently, according to the press release from the US Department of Justice, he was also intending to renounce his US citizenship and had begun looking into how to purchase citizenship from other countries. we do have a tweet on this from a lawyer saying he now represents Virgil Griffith, and apparently he's been released on bail, and they dispute the untested allegations in the criminal complaint, and Virgil looks forward to his day in court when the full story can come out. So I don't know, maybe he just went sightseeing. Maybe he was sampling the local cuisine, you know, taking in some cultural events. I think too, he'd apparently asked the State Department if he could go and they said no and he went anyway. So I don't know, man. Let's see.
Yeah.
And a lot of this, of course, how are you going to get evidence, you know, that he actually presented? That's the thing, unless, you know, they had actual spies there who can say, yeah, no, he delivered a presentation. This will be a hilarious one to watch when it actually gets to court, is my point. Yeah. Don't you think?
Yes. I think it will be. It'll be funny seeing it play out.
Yeah. Now, look, this move has been in the works for a while, but the Department of Homeland Security's CISA agency is pressing forward with its binding directive to make US government departments actually have some sort of vulnerability disclosure policy. They're in the consultation phase, which they're running all via GitHub. And, you know, you look at the policy so far and, you know, the thing that blows me away about all of this is it all just looks really reasonable. What they're going to do is, if you're a government agency, you need to have a vulnerability disclosure policy and at least one internet-connected asset that's part of that policy. And then after 2 years, it has to be all of them. So this sort of seems to be their way of ratcheting it up gradually. I actually reached out to Chris Krebs, who heads the CISA agency, and asked him, you know, how they're going to handle this deluge of bug reports that is inevitably going to follow from introducing these programs. And he was kind enough to supply us with some audio. Here it is.
What we'll do, I think, is set up initially an incremental approach where agencies can define the systems that are in scope for the program, and as they build capacity and capability, you can incrementally increase or expand the number of systems that are in place. At the same time, we'll be working with our partners in industry that do this sort of program management for a living, and see if we can't use more centralized approaches, single or common platforms, to assist departments and agencies, you know, kind of filter out the noise, triage some low-hanging fruit, and put the higher skill assets against the more problematic vulnerabilities. But again, you know, we're going through this in a way that takes feedback from industry, takes feedback from our partners and other departments and agencies, and we'll include that in the final directive when it comes out in a couple months.
So there you go. I mean, it all sounds sensible, which is just something I'm not used to coming out of government. And thanks to Chris for providing that audio when he, like me, as listeners could probably tell, has a bit of a cold.
Yeah, it is really nice seeing, you know, government agencies do sensible things. And I mean, I think what we're seeing here is, you know, the result of a number of years of the US government being on the receiving end of bad things happening to them. Mm. I mean, they've had so many breaches and so many things go wrong and so many things get hacked over the years that they are finally at the point where, you know, like, doing actual sensible, like, you know, practical, real, useful security exercises is, you know, is where they've arrived at, right? I mean, they've spent so much, when I compare it with, you know, other governments, I'm thinking of my own, for example, in New Zealand, where we, you know, we don't really have much in the way of threats. And so there's no pressure on those, on the way that you defend to evolve into something sensible. And I think the US is now kind of, you know, after however many years it's been, 10, 15 years of getting owned, they're starting to do smart things. And this is just a really good example of thinking sensibly about the problem, talking to people who've had the experience of running this in the private sector, you know, talking to all the people around the place that understand this. And, you know, people just do stumble across vulns and bugs all the time. And most of it, if it's a government thing, you're going to go, eh, this is too difficult to report. I'm not going to bother. It's not worth the grief. And you let it be. Mm. And, you know, they get a bunch of free QA as a result of just having to put together some policies. Like, that's smart. Why?
Well, it is. It is. But I like that this plan seems to be somewhat realistic, as in they're not just saying, let's have VDPs for absolutely everything, because they will get crushed, right? So they've got to ratchet up slowly. And I guess they've got to build, you know, because the problem is, right, that a lot of these agencies and departments aren't going to have the skills in-house to deal with the reports that they're getting. So I think that's why they're starting off gently and just seeing how that goes, seeing what the agencies can do autonomously, and then seeing what elements of this need to be centralized. I mean, it all just seems like it could actually wind up being quite useful. Again, shocked.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it has to start slowly for those reasons. And I mean, even just like the cultural aspects of dealing with hackers and the sorts of people who report bugs and they're thinking about the bugs that they report. Because you get a lot of, you know, as anyone who's worked on the other side of receiving, you know, vuln disclosure or bug bounty information, right, you know that the quality of information you get really varies wildly. And understanding, having enough context to read what you get, decide whether it's useful, whether it's helpful, to read through the motives and the way that the person reporting it thinks and get what's actually valuable there, like, that really does take a while and a bunch of experience. So they're going to ramp it up slowly. And the idea of sharing some of that workload with, you know, you would imagine some of the existing commercial bug bounty providers would be pretty happy to, you know, pitch in, you know, offer their services or something to try and smooth over the process. But yeah, obviously you can't start with everything all at once, but starting somewhere is just like, it's a thing that is really helpful for everybody. And that's, yeah, it's it. Good to see it happening.
That's it. And then they can deal with the wonderful reports. We saw this one going around on Twitter today from Bcrypt on Twitter. Yan, got the best, aka worst, HackerOne report ever. Someone reported that an attacker website can figure out a person's IP address by gaining local access to the person's machine, installing a Node.js web server, and then using the IP NPM package to get the IP. What? Yeah. So, you know, that's going to be fun. The government has to deal with.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, there's so many people who've never actually done hacking, but, you know, are still filing bug reports for these things without any real context. So, yes, there's a, you know, we all need to improve, not just the government. I mean, obviously, people who are doing bug bounties and reporting bugs kind of need to think about it a little bit too.
I swear, anyone doing bug triage should get like a intravenous drip of just the right amount of Valium just to keep them. Keep them at the right level to not lose their minds.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It probably is a really miserable job. I'm sorry for all the listeners that have to do that for a living.
But occasionally, and that's the thing, you know, it's needles in haystacks. And, you know, it's funny that, you know, now it's in the application world and, you know, the web security world, but it used to be, you know, the people who dealt with security at Microsoft. Can you imagine what it would have been like sitting on that mailbox? My God.
And you can't tell. Are you getting, well, you can press escape at the login box and, you know, something happens, like the Windows 95 auth bypass where you just hit escape and you don't have to log in anymore. Or whether it's, you know, it's remote pre-auth code exec in the IP stack, you know, and you don't know what you're going to get every time you open a mail. Could be either.
Yeah, that's it. Keeps life exciting. Now, look, we got some news from New Zealand here. Of course, in the wake of the Christchurch shooting, the New Zealand government announced a gun buyback scheme, which is modelled basically on the Australian scheme. 16 that was introduced after the Port Arthur massacre. But there's been some security issues there that have potential for real world harm.
Yeah, so the there was a website where you could register your gun information, and then that would kind of go forward and into this kind of government funded buyback program. And then there were reports in the media that there had been a data breach of the system, that the names and addresses and details of the guns had been exposed. And what had actually transpired was that if you were a gun dealer, you had some kind of elevated access in the system, and as a result, you could see essentially everybody's records. Subsequent reporting suggests that only one user actually accessed that information, but it was certainly reported in the media as like, this is a data breach. It turned out to be that, you know, some role-based permissions were misconfigured in the application by SAP, the software vendor in question. But what was, I mean, it, you know, that the actual breach was not really interesting. What was interesting was that the, you know, it really blew up into a significant issue where our prime minister is fronting this in the media, saying, you know, this data breach has happened and, you know, it doesn't change the validity of the gun buyback program, blah, 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 blah. But what's interesting is that the risk assessment process, like, I mean, thankfully I wasn't involved, like my company didn't do the risk assessment for that site, so thank Christ for that. But, you know, you imagine, like, what's the pen test report for that site look like? Did it report that issue? If it had reported, what would it have rated it from a risk point of view? And all of those kind of questions of how government agencies and entities are meant to go out and buy security services and manage risks, you know, when what they're dealing with fundamentally here are not hacking, right? I mean, it's just like, this is accidental data breach because they misconfigured a thing. And when they get that, you know, that pen test report that says, well, there's no remote code exec in it, so it's probably all right. It's not actually all right, right? I mean, there's all these other things that they need to think about.
I mean, you've got to ask yourself, right? And I'm sure you have, whether or not you would have caught this.
Well, of course, like every time something like this happens, we ask, you know, would we have reported that and what would we have said?
Would you have caught it?
Well, I mean, if it's a role, it depends. Like, was it like that in test? Did we know what the roles were meant to be? Like, did we understand the business rules of the system when we tested it? And the chances are probably not, right? Because very rarely do you get a, you know, here are the business rules for the system as they're meant to be designed, and we can go and review the implementation. Most of the time, we have to make that up, right? We have to invent what the intent of the system is just kind of by gut feel. So would we have spotted it? I don't know. And then the question is, what would we have rated it, right? I mean, likelihood, meh, impact,
Yeah, right? Exactly, square, because it's kind of a trusted community. You know, you got to trust your gun dealers a little bit when it's a heavily regulated and licensed role, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly, right? But then, you know, what I realized thinking about that particular one is that when we rate the risk, right, we're rating it on, you know, what's the worst that could happen? Well, you could own the site. From that, you have, you know, shell command exec on the box. That happens to be running as a privileged user. You get domain admin, you own the entire, like, and we're rating it on a risk scale where the, you know, the bad severity is, you know, from the point of view of a malicious adversary like us that understands what that means. And then someone who's reading that report at the other end, you know, project manager on the gun buyback site, they have no context for what high actually means. And so they look at low and go, well, in the context of my project, low is nothing. Why don't I even care about this issue? It's not even worth reading the pen test report.
Yeah, so this is all about where technical risk meets someone in a balaclava breaking into someone's house to steal a semi-automatic weapon.
Well, yeah, and I mean, also the fact that, you know, when we are assessing risks, we are doing so with an understanding of what the full gamut is. And when other people interpret our reports, they don't know what that full range of risks are from a technical perspective. And so then, you know, they kind of make up their own because they've only got movie hacking to go away, or data breaches, or in this case, you know, accidental data breaches. The only thing we ever have in New Zealand, like, no one actually hacks anything. We never get a real one. And no one's ever seen, like, no one has ever reported on or seen in the media, you know, what an actual, you know, like Sony style, someone actually wants to do damage and has actual, you know, some technical acumen. Like, no one knows what that looks like.
Well, I can think of one, which is when every single pen tester in New Zealand broke into to steal their SQL database so that they'd have a good password database. And then eventually everyone felt guilty about it and told me so I could tell them. And then they thought I was involved in some plot, and it wound up on TV in New Zealand.
I don't know what you're talking about.
anyway, let's just move on from there. I don't even think it was you. I think it was like about five people who told me about that.
Yeah, no, I mean, it genuinely wasn't me, but yeah. I mean, you know.
Oh, dear. Yeah, I'm sure you had a copy of it. Everyone did. Anyway, moving on. Krebs on security. More government stuff. And this is a funny one, actually. Brian Krebs at Krebs on Security has written up one of his contacts had managed to register themselves a .gov domain name pretty easily, pretty much fill in a form, fax it in sort of thing. You know, set up a couple of Google voice numbers and Robert's your mother's brother. There you go. So, yeah, the headline is it's way too easy to get a .gov domain name. Interesting thing in this story. story is, though, that they mentioned that Caesar, the agency that we were just sort of praising a couple of stories ago, is kind of trying to take control of the .gov domain name space.
Yeah, I mean, it's previously been run by the government General Services Administration, and it does seem like there's some appetite to have perhaps a more, you know, cyber focused organization involved with, you know, in the end, it is kind of important, you know, when you've got a zone like that, that people do confer some kind of trust upon, you know, that there is some kind of access control to it. Like there is some reasonable process of doing approvals rather than just, you know, send some letterhead, you know, like a scan of a letterhead. Like it ought to be a little higher bar than that. I mean, you know, certainly we don't rely on certificate authorities to do anything anymore. So maybe the domain name registrars, you know, issuers for particular zones like that could do something. And yeah, perhaps Caesar is better equipped to understand what that means than the GSA were.
Yeah, yeah. So it's a fun little story, though, about the process of how, you know, if you were interested, you might go out and get yourself a .gov domain name, which is going to be useful for all sorts of stuff, like especially now that you can get like free TLS certificates and yeah.
We did one time have a .gov.nz forward for a certain piece of KiwiCon infrastructure that someone helpfully set up for us without asking in the government zone file over here, which was rather an awkward conversation to then go and have to have on the Monday morning after, you know, a few beers on a Friday afternoon. Like, ha ha, wouldn't it be funny if we had an entry in the zone file? And then, you know, next minute we did. So that was a bit awkward.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Adobe has disclosed a breach impacting Magento Marketplace users. And this is such a typical Adobe breach, which is like, it's always the acquisitions. I mean, sometimes they've had some problems at like Adobe, you know, core infrastructure, but usually that's like real attackers. You know what I mean? And in this case, it's just like, you know, it's Magento. So yeah, they acquired Magento, of course, about 18 months ago. And I can tell Brad Arkin, who is a, you know, he's a friend of mine. He's the chief security officer of Adobe. I can tell he would have had his usual panic attack when he was doing the post-acquisition inspection of their infrastructure. And yeah, this is the sort of thing that happens. Although it doesn't look like the end of the world, this one.
No, the question I had is does the Magento marketplace run Magento?
Yeah, I'm funny. Curious, right?
Like, yeah, because like if they got breached by Magento bugs in the Magento marketplace, that would at least be pretty funny.
That's pretty meta, man. Wow.
But no, it seems like a bunch of people got their data nicked from it. It's not clear whether people, I mean, I'm trying to think what you could do with the Magento marketplace other than steal the data. I mean, if you could backdoor the apps that were being, you know, the plugins that are being sold by it or delivered by it, then that would be interesting. But there doesn't seem to be any evidence that has actually happened here. It just seems like, you know, data being nicked. So,
yeah,
you know, you could do better, hackers. You could do better.
You can do better, yeah. Apparently, there is some vuln in fully patched Android that's being exploited in the wild by, like, rogue apps and stuff. But it looks like a pretty bad set of bugs or bug or what would you even call this?
I guess that's a technique maybe more than a bug.
Yeah, that's why I split that hair, you know?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is a trick that an app running on your phone can use to, like, use the sort of multitasking features of Android to cause the malicious app to be invoked when you start an app that you trust, and then it's running in what you as the user think is the trusted app's context, and it can ask you for, like, I need more permissions, or I need your account credentials or something, and then it can use that. So you open your banking app and it asks for your creds and you enter them, but it's actually you're interacting with the fake app that's used this kind of activity, like, what do they call it, the flag activity new task intent to get itself in front of you. So it's sort of a social engineering trick assisted by the OS not being clear about what application you're actually using.
Yeah, it's like sleight of hand, isn't it?
Yeah, it kind of is. Yeah, and pretty smart. So it's not surprising that you know, that there are a bunch of apps using this to do bad things.
Is it easy to fix?
So I think, I mean, Google's been trying to flag applications that use it in the marketplace. I mean, not being an Android dev, I'm not 100% sure whether this is intended behavior or whether it's kind of like a misuse of a thing that, like, it's not meant to work like that or not. So I'm not sure whether they can fix it by changing the behavior or whether this is the sort of thing they have to scan at the app store level and try and spot when things get published.
Yeah. Now, we've got two stories here, one from ZDNet and one from CyberScoop, both talking about the takedown of the so-called IMRAT malware operation. This was just like a remote access Trojan sold as, you know, oh, it's a system administration tool, but it was clearly used for bad stuff. This was an investigation led by the Australian Federal Police. Apparently, you know, the makers had sold this thing to like 15,000 people over a period of 7 years, right? So, like, it's just one of those outfits that, like, finally law enforcement got around to doing a bit of a takedown. They've shut down all of their infrastructure. They've arrested a bunch of their customers. What's interesting, the reason I mentioned we got two stories here is because the CyberScoop one says that nobody in Australia was arrested, and the ZDNet one says that Australians were arrested in Australia. So I don't even know exactly where all of these arrests have occurred, but the TLDR is that rat is no longer available to purchase. You'll have to find another one.
Yeah, and of course there are a whole bunch of other options, yeah. But I mean, this is just kind of part of the natural life cycle of these sorts of things. When the IAM rat picked up a bunch of its users because some of the earlier rats got taken out by law enforcement. So it's just kind of, you know, the customer base will migrate to the next tool that does much the same thing, and, you know, the police will raid a few more people, and so life continues.
On and on it goes. It's funny, right, because Catalin Kimpanu has a screen cap from a forum in his version of the story where he's like, yeah, I had a bunch of cybersecurity and police officers show up at my door yesterday. I don't have this software installed anymore, and pretty sure I never actually used it for anything, laughing my ass off. So there you go. Few doors being knocked on, let's put it that way. Now this is a metal storm story if ever I've heard one, because this is totally not my jam. Carsten Knoll's company, Security Research Labs, two of his colleagues, Luca Milete and Sina Yazdanmeh, I've got no idea how I did there, probably terribly. But they're going to be presenting some findings on this new way that telcos are sending SMS messages, right? There's a new type of protocol, I guess, called the rich communication service that telcos are switching to. And apparently they are not all implementing it all that well. And it's pretty bad. Talk me through it.
Yeah, so this the standard RCS is meant to kind of functionally replace the original, you know, GSM, SMS, short message service messaging, and provide, you know, a bunch of the features that people expect in modern communications platforms, you know, group messaging and file transfer and better handling of multimedia, all that kind of thing. And, you know, obviously SMS is not particularly well suited for that these days. So it provides that functionality. And, of course, the telcos don't want to be tied to, you know, iMessage or Google Messenger or whatever. So there's this kind of push to have a standardized way of doing, you know, instant messaging and presence and all that kind of thing on mobile platforms. The standard came out. Google is pushing it on Android.
So this isn't a way to route SMS per se. It's kind of like a replacement for SMS.
Yeah, well, I mean, SMS, I mean, was, you know, as...
Well, SMS was an accident, right? It was on the signal channel, more or less, right?
Exactly, yeah. Right. SMS was never really intended to be as big as it was, and became one of the main things that the platforms were used for. And, you know, by virtue of being in a weird signaling channel and having a bunch of strange properties that made it kind of adjacent to the rest of the network, as opposed to running, you know, on top of it in the way that IP does, the idea with RCS was that it would be much more like a normal messaging protocol, like a Jabber or an XMPP or, you know, something like that, where, you know, you talk IP across the network to a messaging service, you log in, you go about your business, but it provides that messaging functionality on your phone that SMS used to. Where this has kind of gone off the rails is less the standard and more the implementation. And the researchers from SR Labs have been looking at the implementations of this by phone vendors, by telcos, and people have been adopting it. And of course, there's, you know, there's just a bunch of edge cases that people, you know, when they build these things to the spec, don't really think about. I mean, stuff like, how do you bind the identity of the end user to the account that they've created with the messaging platform? You know, one example they gave was, you know, you get sent you know, a numeric code when you try to authenticate, when you originally set up your account, and then you have to enter that to prove that you have control of the SIM card and the number. And you can just try as many times as you want. So you can guess their six-digit number, you know, and that's no problem. Or, you know, whatever other mechanisms they come up with. There's a bunch of kind of, you know, that sort of full system bug, you know, account lifecycle, full system.
Why are we bothering with this when we do actually have some pretty decent, you know, messaging over IP things happening? Like, why is this needed?
Well, but it's because the telcos don't necessarily want to cede control of this to other vendors.
I don't think that's their choice, to be honest. You know.
I mean, certainly Apple has, you know, shown that it is possible for the tech industry to kind of leverage control over the telcos and take that away.
Well, I think to a greater degree, WhatsApp's user base just stomps them.
Well, yeah, and yeah, things like WhatsApp and all of the rest of the Google ecosystem really have pushed the telcos into being a dumb network operator, which they didn't really want to, right? They wanted the, you know, bill you for everything walled garden future that they originally created. And this is them just kind of trying to claw this back.
Remember when they wanted to be content companies? That was hilarious.
Yeah, exactly, right? And, you know, in the end, this will, you know, kind of sputter along just because SMS does need to be replaced. But expecting telcos to do a good job of this stuff, unfortunately, is just not realistic. And they're going to keep cocking it up. And, you know, Carsten Noll and friends are going to keep finding sweet bugs in it and life carries on.
So I'm guessing the way this is going to work is, you know, your standard SMS messenger client on, you know, iOS and Android, it will try using this protocol to route messages. But if the receiving end doesn't use it or whatever, it'll revert to SMS. Is it going to be that sort of thing?
I suspect that's what we'll see. I mean, similarly, yeah. as we've seen, you know, Google try to integrate their messaging all into one application on Android, and, you know, it just becomes challenging for users to understand what's going on. You see it the same with iMessage falling back to SMS as well. It can be a kind of confusing user experience, but I think that's what we're going to see.
Yeah. Yay. The FBI. We've got a couple of stories relating to FBI advice at the moment. The FBI is warning people about smart TV security. Look, this seems probably not like the most important message that the FBI could be putting out there. But the thing that I found interesting in this piece, a couple of things I found interesting about it, actually, this one courtesy of CyberScoop, is the amount of tracking that smart TV manufacturers are doing is getting a little bit problematic, at least as far as I'm concerned. They're doing things like keeping an eye on what you watch so they can better target advertisements towards you and things like that. And it's just like, this is just that continuation of the trend of trying to monetize all user activity. It's terrible.
Yeah, and I think people are, you know, not really used to the idea of having all of the devices all doing their own independent kind of monitoring of them. I mean, people, I guess, imagine, you know, when you watch advertising on TV, there's kind of an understood bargain. You're watching the ads to pay for the content, right? Yeah. And when you view a website, you're watching the ads to pay for the content. But if your laptop also was tracking everything you're doing to then sell that data to somebody else, like, people don't necessarily expect that. And even less so of what they think of as a passive device, TV.
Well, and this is
it's just an Android device with a really big screen.
The next thing I was going to get to, though, is that your ability to opt out of this sort of stuff is, you know, that window of escape is really narrowing. I've bought a bit of, you know, I've moved house recently. I bought a soundbar. Won't work unless it's on Wi-Fi. It's just like, no. And I'm currently in the market for a new television. And same thing, right? Like, these things, you can't just disable these crappy features. And it could be a problem in the future, you know, meaningful problem.
Well, I mean, it certainly means it's going to stop working when whatever, you know, rubbish Samsung cloud service supports the back end of it disappears in a few years' time. Yeah, I mean, people don't really understand how connected everything is and what that all means, both in terms of privacy and in terms of, you know, just availability. Like, what's going to happen when AWS region goes away near you and all of a sudden your TV doesn't work?
Yeah, that's going to be interesting.
You know, nothing of value may be lost, but, you know, still.
Except your television, you know? Like, come on. Meanwhile, the FBI, in response to a bunch of questions from a senator, has said that, you know, the US government or elements of the US government, politicians in the US were asking the FBI, you know, is Face App, and this was that Russian app where you could take a picture of your face and age yourself, you know, is this some sort of huge security problem? And the FBI has basically come back and said all Russian apps are potentially a security and counterintelligence problem. So,
I mean, and they're not wrong, right?
We're
at the point where, you know, running software, running hardware from a country you're competing with in geopolitics is a risk. And I guess the only thing you can really say there is, if you think it's bad in the US because you've got one app, that, you know, novelty app that makes you look funny, imagine what it's like being Russia and having to run Windows on Intel or AMD, right? I mean, you know, when your entire ecosystem runs on other people's software and hardware, it's like, they're the ones that really have got the bigger problem rather than the US. At least the US can still make that stuff domestically.
Yeah, I guess it is funny, right? Like, cry to me about your supply chain.
Exactly, right?
Now, speaking of supply chain, this next story I love, you know, this is almost as funny as the first one. We got two here that are our skateboarding dogs. We didn't put them at the end because they're just too good. HPE has issued a bit of a warning to some of its customers that some listeners might find somewhat humorous.
Oh, yeah, it's so funny. So HP makes a bunch of things, including serial-attached SCSI SSD drives that you might have in storage arrays or servers or that kind of thing. Anyway, they've released a warning that if you leave your disk on for what feels suspiciously like signed short int max hours,
32,768,
which is, say, about 3 years, 270 days, if you leave your drive running for that long, it will brick itself, and you can't have your data back.
Hard drive seppuku.
Yes. So if you have a really big HP storage array full of those sorts of disks, you might want to patch the firmware on your disks before they all fail, like within, you know, kind of plus or minus a few hours of each other, assuming you powered all the disks on, you know, kind of, you know.
And you can imagine how they found this out, right? Like that someone had a bad day.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Big old slice of schadenfreude pie for breakfast to me. That's just, it's so good. I love it.
But can you imagine, oh, wow, we lost a disk in that array, you know, like, oh, okay, we just lost, what? What? You know, it's gonna
exactly.
Be that sort of now, not to be so outdone beautiful. With a with a dumb product bug, Splunk. this one's awesome. Now, you remember, you're old like me. You remember the whole panic about Y2K. It was a big technology challenge. The world rose to solve it. But some people, man, short memories. Kids these days.
Yeah.
Tell us about this Splunk bug.
So Splunk's a little bit behind the times on the Y2K bug. Apparently, some of the regular expressions which parse date stamps of incoming messages that the Splunk kind of log ingest engine is parsing, the regex that handles two-digit years there, it's going to stop working at the end of this year and will start parsing dates wrong or rejecting them entirely as invalid. So yes, if your seam is Splunk and you're having all of your logs injected into it, you might have a problem if you're managing two-digit years. And they also point out, whilst you're patching this bug, you might want to patch the one that's coming up next year when Splunk will fail to parse Unix epoch times, which, let's face it, is way more common than two-digit years. So, yeah, bad time to be adminning a Splunk system. So,
well, you know, hey, at least there's something that's going to make Splunk admins actually patch, right? Because you can imagine all of the ones that they've ignored until now because they don't affect functionality. And now, you know, they're going to have to patch or their Splunks won't work.
I do love Splunk. I've only ever seen it when I've shelled other people's Splunks to look at them looking at me, but it seems pretty good.
That's good. Now, you know, bizarrely, CyberArk just keep pumping out the goods, man. Some good research here involving Microsoft Azure accounts.
Yeah, so this is some research into the specific implementation of OAuth authentication inside Azure. And what they did was, so when you get OAuth tokens issued from an authentication service, there's kind of a list of people that are allowed to, or a list of sites that those tokens are valid for and will be presented to by your browser. So that, you know, if you get a token to authenticate to some Azure service, that you can't just, you're not going to go, your browser's not going to go and give that off to some other website that asks for it. So there's a set of kind of access controls. And what they did here was they looked at the list of sites that were whitelisted to receive OAuth credentials from the Azure authentication process and then realized that a bunch of the whitelisted domains include domain name space where end user customer stuff in the cloud platform. So Microsoft have a bunch of domains like azurewebsites.net where you can cause domain names to be created as part of, you know, running stuff on Azure. So they realized that there's a bunch of spaces in there where they were in the default whitelists. So they went and registered a bunch of those. And at that point, now you can steal OAuth tokens from people. And then
so hang on, were they
them.
Wildcard or did you have to have specific access to specific like dangled domains?
No, that seemed like there's just a bunch of specific domains, so not wildcards, just specific domains that I guess at some point had been valid, but has subsequently been relinquished.
This is like your typical sort of CDN dangling domain takeover style thing, but it gets you OAuth.
Yeah, basically, yes. Yeah, it's stuff that's been relinquished and now has been taken over by someone else in the same way that, yeah, a dangling domain in a CDN. But yeah, the impact here, of course, is you can take those OAuth credentials and then use them to connect back to Azure and, you know, reset passwords or whatever other, you know, other things you might want to do against the API endpoint. So yeah, kind of a good example of, I mean, it's kind of a configuration issue, right, rather than a bug, but it's a good example of the sorts of things that if you are reviewing, you know, complicated OAuth setups or other people's SSO configurations, that it's the sort of thing that has a pen tester you're going to need to be able to spot. So yeah, worth a read.
Moving to some law and order.
But we had all those FBI ones before and you didn't
yeah,
even
this
press
one,
the button.
This one's, I don't know. Okay, let me press the button when I want to press the button. Leave me alone, guy. A guy in Texas has been charged and this guy had basically been like owning up music producers. He stole 50 gig of music and then started publishing the music on public forums. I mean, look, this is jerk behavior and I'm sure the guy deserves to be charged, but he's looking at 20 years, man, which I think feels a little bit heavy. I don't think he's been to court yet, but yeah, that's the scenario.
Yeah, to be fair, this guy is kind of a dick. Like when he realized he was going to get rolled, he ended up like
trying to blame someone else. Yeah, real classy.
Like trying to frame some other guy for all of this, and then tried to cooperate with the investigation to frame the other guy. And this sounds like a real piece of shit. So
he should get an extra couple of years for trying to be a snitch.
Like, exactly.
Yeah, but maybe not 20. That's a bit.
I mean, 20 does seem a lot for stealing. Well, let's face it, it's probably pretty rubbish music.
Oh, rubbish. If it's not Swedish death metal, it's terrible.
Exactly.
That's the Adam way. We got a report here from Microsoft. You know, Microsoft obviously has excellent telemetry, best in the world, right? When it comes to endpoints, at least on desktops, on PCs. And malware, ransomware, and crypto miner detections are down in 2019. I think the number was something like 6 to 7%, which is kind of interesting. I think they're attributing this to more people running Win10.
Yeah, and that's probably not an unreasonable thing to say. I mean, the older Windows were definitely more prone to being owned by stuff. But I think the real difference here is that, you know, the relevance of owning individual end user desktops, like in the way that we've seen it done, you know, in the old days, you know, of large scale worms and viruses targeting end users. Like, that's just not how anyone does it anymore. Like, it's not important. It's not relevant. Right? People go after big corporations.
It's just a good way to burn your bugs, right?
It is, right? Yeah. And you're much better off using your bugs more in a more targeted way against bigger organizations that, if your goal is ransomware, you know is going to pay.
Whereas how to segue. You have learned how to segue so beautifully over the years, Adam. Because our next story, of course, is a write-up from Sean Gallagher, who's done a bit of, you know, really good journalism here. He's spoken to a few sources familiar with the state of Louisiana's IT operations. Of course, you know, I think we spoke about it last week or the week before. Louisiana had been ransomware. It looked like they'd managed to contain it okay. It looks like, you know, the damage has been a bit worse than we first suspected, and they're still sort of battling to contain it. It looks like a couple of their domain controllers got popped and were being used to propagate the malware through the networks, and they're still sort of fighting it. But, you know, they're in there fighting the good fight. What can we infer from this report?
Yeah, it certainly does sound like they got themselves domain admin level compromised, and they were using, apparently the TrickBot was using a group policy to spread, which does imply they got proper owned.
Does kind of suggest that, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does kind of. So, I mean, the question is, how, you know, coming back from a compromise like that in a way that's comprehensive, you know, actually throwing out an adversary, you know, especially if it's a human, right, rather than, I mean, that's the thing with these kind of ransomware crews is, you know, they pick the targets and then they make sure they're in position before they trigger it so that they get maximum return on their initial intrusion. But you'd be kind of dumb to not hang about, right, to not make sure you got ways back in. So throwing someone out who's got that level of access, it's pretty difficult. And even if you've only had 1,000 boxes ransomware, you don't know that there isn't 3 boxes somewhere else in the network that are going to provide the way back in 6 months from now. And that's just a real rough ride.
Yeah, so it looks like some data lost, some data out of date. I don't think it's going to be entirely clear like how bad this has affected them for another couple of weeks, right? Because you've got to see how much data are you going to lose? Because quite often with backups, it's just a question that they're maybe a little bit old.
Yeah, and also, I mean, the process of actually restoring from a backup is often not as simple as just rolling tape, you know. Even if you can get the data off, even if you can find the tapes, even if the backup works, even if the tape works and you get the data off, then you've got to try and turn that back into a functioning system. And that's where you find out that, you know, the sysadmin never actually stopped the database, checkpointed it down to disk before they wrote the backups out, or, you know, all of the other things that people assume, you know, oh, we'd have a snapshot of the virtual machine, it'll be fine. Well, maybe it's not that simple, you know.
Yeah.
So actually turning backups into a restore, it's a thing that, you know, most people underestimate the complexity of unless you've, you know, actually done this for a living.
Sounds like a market opportunity for me, to me, man. Like, this is a crazy thing, isn't it? Like, we still suck at backup, and it's ransomware that is teaching us this.
Yeah, and of course the question now is, once everyone's put everything in the cloud, it doesn't have backups anymore because we've just got the cloud, we've got 2 availability zones, surely it's fine. Then what are you going to do?
Yeah.
You know, because let's see you recover from having your Amazon account ransomware, because, I mean, there's a market opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know. I mean, that's kind of like in Amazon's realm, right? Like, I'm guessing the people at the good folks at Amazon have kind of thought about that.
Yeah, well, probably. But we haven't really seen it. You know, nothing works until it's been wrecked a few times, right? And, yeah, you know. We'll see what happens.
Very quickly, Mozilla has nuked a couple of Firefox extensions by Avast and AVG. Of course, these are supposed to be security extensions, but they were caught sort of recording a little bit too much info. This strikes me as perhaps sloppy rather than malicious. What's your take?
Yeah, I mean, that's why this is why we're talking about it, right, is that they are vendors that really, from a public relations perspective, ought to know better than letting their plugins snoop on people's stuff. I mean, obviously, there's loads of browser plugins that do sketchy stuff to make their business model work, but if you're going to slap your name on it and you're a Avast or AVG, then you do kind of need to have a better handle on it. And whether it's, you know, malice or whether it's just kind of, you know, they got a bit fast and loose with the business model and didn't really think about it, you know, either way, the PR people are going to have to deal with it. And I imagine, you know, they're not feeling too happy.
Joe Cox at Motherboard reports that the FBI has asked Sony for data on a user who allegedly used the PlayStation Network to sell cocaine. Now, this guy was apparently doing like in-game communications, which is a trick as old as the hills. You know, various things got him into trouble where he's like texting associates saying, hey, are you in the game? If you want to talk to me, you got to be in the game, buy the game. You know, like that tends to give away your OPSEC a little bit there, pal. Mm. But, you know, this guy wasn't selling grams. He was selling kilograms, which I just think is hilarious. Like, you know, shifting, you know, mid to high level distributor using a PlayStation. Dude, you signal. What are you doing?
Yeah, exactly right. I guess, yeah, it's this kind of folk wisdom about, you know, what's a safe communication mechanism that the police can't see. I don't know that in-game chat is exactly that.
It doesn't look like the feds have been able to recover any actual audio recordings because they didn't ask for them, but I'm guessing it's the metadata that they're going to be chasing here.
Sure, and knowing who's in game with who and that kind of thing is probably what they're after. I mean, I don't know that it's reasonable that without a warrant in place to actually capture the data that, you know, you would expect Sony to be recording the audio.
Of course not. But I'm just saying, like, it's, you know, it's not the end of the, you know, it's not like they got the tapes just yet.
No, not yet. But it's kind of funny though that they were, you know, getting a warrant to go after the guys like, you know, PlayStation achievements and stuff. it makes sense, right, to ask for all the data. And of course, you know, you want to know what, you know, if you look at the amount of played time per game, you kind of know which ones are being used for recreation, which ones are being used for business. And I guess there's a bunch of reasons, you know, if you've got all this time in game, but no achievements, clearly you're not playing it. So there's a bunch of reasons why you want that sort of data. But it's just kind of funny.
Can't wait to read the indictment. It's going to be a fun read. And look, we're going to end it with some news. Listeners would remember Sandbox Escaper, who just had a habit of dropping O'Day on Twitter, has sort of resurfaced under a different account name. I think this is legit, right?
Who knows on the internet anymore, but probably. Let's take it at face value.
We're going to take it at face value, right? And had been posting, like, one of the things she posted was, like, a screen cap of, like, all of the bounties they'd got from Microsoft for bugs recently, which seems like it was, like, 100K, you know, $100,000 or something, which seems like a better way to roll than just dropping them on Twitter for everyone. she's now apparently landed herself a job at Microsoft, so well done.
Yeah, good job. Good, I hope it's a good job. But yeah, it's nice to see people who, you know, seemed a bit troubled, you know, getting a good job and hopefully, you know, good opportunities ahead of her. So yeah,
I'll wish her,
you know, all sorts of good luck and, you know, find some sweet bugs, I'm sure, with access to a little bit more Microsoft source. There's probably plenty more to find.
I'm not sure if it's a bug hunting job or a patching job. I'm not sure exactly what the job is, but either way, you know, it's good to be brought into the fold and, you know, it's good. Onwards and upwards, Sandbox Escaper.
Yeah, exactly. Just be gentle to the internal corp AD. Like, you know they're watching it, right? So just be gentle. Yeah, just
pro tip. Don't go straight
for the Kerberos.
Maybe not. All right, Adam, that is it for the week's news. Always so much fun. It's going to be weird when we break for Christmas because, it's always so much fun. But I'll chat to you again next week for our last show of the year.
Yeah, looking forward to it. And I'll talk to you then, Pat.
That was Adam Boileau there with a check of the week's security news. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with BlackBerry Silence chief evangelist, hallelujah, Brian Robison. In October, the company published a report all about mobile malware. It was called Mobile Malware and APT Espionage, Prolific, Pervasive and Cross-Platform. Brian joined me to discuss the key themes of the report and here's what he had to say.
Well, in the report, we illustrated several different examples of where, you know, more traditional kind of desktop APT groups have actually incorporated mobile malware into their, you know, kind of cross-platform attacks, if you will. And we highlighted several. We also named a few new ones that have never been kind of named or seen before. And it kind of gives a perspective into what the the different kind of attackers are trying to do and what motivations are kind of behind these specific attacks.
So which platforms are being most commonly targeted? I'd imagine Android's going to be a big part of that.
Yeah, in this report, most of it was focused on Android, although we have seen specific targeted malware attacks on iOS as well.
Yeah, yeah. Obviously, our listeners would be familiar with some of the recent attacks targeting the Uyghur diaspora. And this malware that you were, as you say, you were mostly focused on Android threats. How is this malware actually getting onto those devices? Was this just through browser exploits and things like that, or socially engineering someone into installing a malicious APK? Like, how are these actors actually getting it done?
Well, yeah, there's a couple of different ways that we've seen it being done. One is, as you mentioned, social engineering the user is usually the easiest way to get that user to install bad code. So whether it's, going to a website on your normal browser or whatever, and you sign up for this service that allows you to communicate securely with other people, you've got to install this, app that we have as well to do that on your mobile device. That's one way. We've also seen examples of these applications being actually published on public app stores and, purporting to have services that could be utilized for the user's benefit, but actually have malicious intent instead.
I'd imagine too, when you do hear of these occasional applications that wind up in app stores, but they've only ever had 50 downloads. And I kind of wonder if that's just an extension of this social engineering approach, but actually getting something published into the app store gives the application much more legitimacy according to the user. So it's like you can say to the user, go to the app store and download this application, and it seems much more legit. Do you think that's a factor?
It's absolutely a factor, Patrick. I think as users, we've become really cavalier with what we choose to install on mobile devices. We feel that, these app stores have done some due diligence to keep us safe as a society. But in fact, really, as long as a developer meets the requirements of the app store, so things like, they've got to have a proper, EULA in place. They've got to, if they access specific device APIs, they have to ask the user for permission to access those, and if they ask for money, they specifically have to use the app store's method of asking for money. But once, pretty much all of those kind of, T's are crossed and I's are dotted, the app can get on the app store. And the intent of the app actually doesn't really come into a lot of the app store testing.
We have seen, though, Google has announced it's pulling together a bit of a coalition of AV companies to sort of work on this problem. Do you think that will bear some fruit? Because, it'd have to, right? Considering it's been so lackluster until now.
I think it will definitely help. But then again, when you look at the end user who is so interested in getting to whatever that end result is, that in a lot of cases, they're simply willing to do things that are off the app store. I think it will definitely help in situations where, let's say, we lock down a device to only be able to install apps from app stores. But, even on iOS, you've got, the concept of sideloading an app into an iOS device. That any user can do. And really, the only thing the user actually has to do is say, I accept this, unsigned certificate kind of thing, and then the app will run. So, on the Android side, you can, put apps in email, links to apps in emails that just download from web services. There's, many third-party app stores that, purport themselves as being repository of old apps that aren't supported anymore or that are deleted by the developers. And people go hunting for these things specifically. And if one of these were compromised, us as an end user would really have, really no way of knowing that that actually occurred.
Yeah, that is absolutely true. And I think one of the most interesting mobile malware campaigns I saw was when some actor was going around breaking into people's PCs and then messing with their iTunes in such a way that they could perform that enterprise sodaliting from the victim's own computer. That was pretty badass. I thought that was kind of cool, actually. I'm not sure if you can still do that, but it was pretty cool.
Well, and we've also seen, you know, in the past, there's, you know, some of the, for example, some of the iOS attacks that were, you know, that came out kind of talking about this last summer, you know, they actually came from a compromised version of Apple's Xcode, you know, software building tool.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was, and know, that was, they were just putting it out there so people could pirate it, right? And it was a Trojan version. It was very cool.
Yeah, not just pirated, it was actually, you know, in a lot of locations, the connection to download it from Apple would take forever to download it. But they could download it from a local, you know, let's say in country or in region repository at a much faster rate.
Well, I guess, so, yeah, piracy isn't the right word there, right? But it was certainly like non-legitimate, non-Apple sourced copies. And I think people were even torrenting versions of Trojan versions of Xcode because you could just get it quick, right?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, speed of access to the end result is a very highly, you know, utilized social engineering tactic.
Yeah. Now, look, we have seen a bit of a lag, I guess, in mobile malware as compared to PC-based APT-style malware, which has been around forever, right? And it's my feeling that mobile malware, yeah, look, it's just a little bit behind, right? It's still, it is used and it has been used for a long while, but it has also been used kind of sparingly. It definitely feels like this year that's changed, right? We've seen these NSO-based WhatsApp malware campaigns, you know, the Pegasus going everywhere. We've seen the attacks against the Uyghur diaspora in and around the Xinjiang region in China. Is it your feeling that we're finally starting to see real proliferation of mobile malware? Because it certainly feels like that to me.
I would agree with that, Patrick. I think we see the capabilities of these groups kind of exploding, and we also see the proliferation exploding. Again, like you said, whether it's based on, you know, state-sponsored type of actors, or it's maybe sponsored by or actually, you know, done by the state itself to keep an eye on, you know, political dissidents or whatever the motivation is, I do feel that I think we are getting to a point where it's going to become a much bigger problem.
Now, I mean, we've been claiming this is going to be an issue for a long time, right? I mean, we've seen anti-mobile malware plays have existed for like a decade, right? And yet we haven't quite seen the threat materialize in a meaningful way. That feels like it's changing now, and that seems like what you're saying.
Well, I think most of what we have seen in the past talked about is mobile nuisance ware.
Yeah, adware, you know, and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, that's not really on the malicious side, right? It's not designed to exfiltrate data out of, you know, your mobile, you know, productivity apps, for example.
It's like the Yahoo browser toolbar style of thing, right?
Exactly, right? It's kind of nuisanceware, but it's not necessarily attached to something specific, malicious, and targeted. And I think that's kind of the shift in the genre, really, of what we've seen in you know, mobile, you know, nuisanceware, moving to more of mobile traditional malware, where, you know, the apps are actually able to provide espionage, you know, data sets to whatever group is looking at, whether they're tracking your location or they are, you know, turning on the microphones or cameras, you know, without your knowledge, those kind of things. Or even just straight up exfiltrating data off of the device, like your messages and your SMS messages and your call logs and everything else that they could get access to if you as a user, you know, approved access to those different repositories.
It does feel like if you're a bad faith actor, right? If you're a criminal, you're probably going to want access to someone's desktop, right? Because that's where the business happens. Whereas if you're a spy, mobile is going to be the preferred target. And it feels to me like this might explain why in the PC realm, you know, we saw proliferation of crimeware first. And in mobile, it sort of feels like it's going to be more fertile ground for espionage rather than crimeware. You know, I mean, what are you going to do when you ransomware someone's Android phone? They're going to restore it from backup.
Yeah, it's a different platform, right? I mean, on the desktop side, most of our desktop laptop devices don't have precision GPS tracking capabilities, right? And you know, while we do have webcams and things like that, you know, there's visual notifications whether those things are on. There's little lights next to them, where on mobile devices there is not. And again, like you said, you know, the motivation of targeting a desktop is because it contains gigabytes of valuable data. The motivation for attacking a mobile device is not necessarily after the data that might be stored there, but more of the behavior of the user who's actually holding the device, I think is a lot more of what's being targeted.
Now, obviously, BlackBerry Silence, this is two companies that have become one. One is a mobile, best known, I guess, for its mobile platforms. I understand they're doing a big push into IoT and all that sort of stuff. And Silence, obviously, is an AV play. So, you know, do you have plans to push stuff out into the mobile realm? Do you already have products for that? I'm just curious.
We actually already have products in beta, which is really nice because it's only been, you know, really a few months since the acquisition of the two different companies, but, taking essentially Silence's, innovative AI approach essentially to predicting malware, bringing that to specifically, for example, the Android platform is something that we already kind of have in beta for our existing customers.
But you can't really do much about iOS, can you? Because you can't get the access to the OS that you need to be useful.
That's true. And in fact, in Android, you know, you're also limited as well, too, because, you know, each app launches in its own user mode. You don't really have access to kernel APIs.
Yeah, and file system access across the whole whack is a bit tricky. Right.
So, kind of the first example of this, what we've done is for iOS, for example, we have sideloading detection so that we can detect whether apps have been installed via sideloaded methods. And this, and on Android, we actually do have essentially, what one would consider more traditional AV approach, which is we can see that an app has been installed, and we can actually check that against the Silence repository of malicious apps, or actually upload that app directly from the device and actually do, a malware scan on it in our, cloud environment and report back within milliseconds whether that app is actually malicious or not. Now, like you said, I mean, we can't stop the user from installing apps. We can't stop them from running apps. But these techniques are actually built into the BlackBerry applications themselves. So while we can't stop the device from getting compromised, what we can do is in the BlackBerry apps themselves that are separately encrypted and separately containerized, protected from the device, we can basically treat those apps and use rules in those apps to treat the device as non-compliant anymore, meaning that the user is unable to access or decrypt any sort of data contained within the BlackBerry apps until the device is fixed essentially and rendered compliant again, then the user can get back to work using the BlackBerry apps.
Okay, Brian Robison, that is very interesting stuff. And as you heard, listeners, if you're an existing client of Silence, you can go try out their AV for Android devices. It's been a pleasure chatting to you. Thanks a lot.
You're very welcome, Patrick, and it's been an absolute pleasure.
That was Brian Robison of BlackBerry Silence there. Big thanks to him for that, and huge thanks to BlackBerry Silence for all of its support over the years. And that is it for this week's show. I will be publishing a Soapbox edition in coming days, and then, one more weekly show left for the year before we break for Christmas. 2019 went by so quickly. Anyway, that is it from me today. I do hope you've enjoyed this week's show. Until next time, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.